Hello there, and welcome to the Last Horror Podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. I can't even begin to imagine the number of podcasts that are coming out this weekend or early into next week that are going to be about the life of George A. Romero. Traditionally, I try and avoid covering stuff that other people will cover in bulk. I make a joke of the fact that the world has enough Saw retrospectives, and as such, I wouldn't normally do an obituary podcast. And I'm trying to make this not an obituary as such. I'm very aware as well that if I was being honest, I would probably in the past, if I'd done a podcast about George Romero, which in fairness I've toyed with many times, I would have probably set it out much in the same way I did the John Waters podcast a few weeks ago, kind of going through his work, where it stands, my own feelings on it, and kind of giving a bit of a potted stomp in history through Romero. But you are now, I am sure, awash with a particular type of podcast, where mobile people will do that. And they'll give their own impressions and feelings on the great man himself. And I'm sure a lot of them will focus on his zombie films, because that's obviously what he's most famous for. And, you know, there are plenty of those in his canon. And you could argue that he made, effectively, two trilogies, the classic Dead trilogy and then this modern version. And his more recent comic book as well, the 15-issue line that he did with Marvel, which feels very much like a Romero comic, and we'll talk about that. And maybe kind of dance on some other stuff, The Crazies, perhaps, or Martin in particular, which is probably his most famous critically influential and interested non-zombie movie. Or maybe they'll focus on Creepshow, etc. And there's a lot that you can go at with Romero's back catalogue. And no doubt all of them will end with the fact that Survival of the Dead was, you know, quite disappointing. But you can't let that influence the fact that he was so influential. And indeed, he created a genre.
Welcome to a night of total terror. Night of the living dead, the dead who live on living flesh, the dead whose haunted souls hunt the living whose bodies are the only food for these ungodly creatures. Dead. A bizarre adventure in fear. An experience in shock more shattering than your strangest nightmare. Night of the living dead. A night with the dead who cannot die. A night of total terror. Night. Of the living dead. Welcome to a night of total terror. Night of the living dead, the dead who live on living flesh, the dead whose haunted souls hunt the living whose bodies are the only food for these ungodly creatures.
So with that in mind, I thought to myself, well, you kind of got that all socked off already, haven't you? So what I'm going to do instead is kind of just speak about Ramiro, his influence on me as a person, and kind of explain to you why probably the loss of George has impacted on me more than any other celebrity death, if I'm being honest. So it's what I'd say is there were probably two moments as a teenager that had a big impact on me when I was getting into horror. Well, three really. The first one would be when I watched Ghostwatch at the age of 12, which I've touched on before. And then there were two others, both Romero's first two zombie movies had a huge impact on me. The first, obviously, I think I watched Night of the Living Dead first, of cheekily one evening. I think it was on one of the channels late at night, and I kind of snuck and watched it. And what stuck with me about that was you felt very much with the characters. One of the key reasons for that, I think, is the way it was shot. Black and white, 1968. A filmmaker who uses handheld cameras in a slightly guerrilla style to create a B-movie, effectively. But one that far transcends its background of being a B-movie. Night of the Living Dead is effectively very similar to something like The Alamo or any number of siege cowboys and Indians dramas where there's a group of people locked in a space surrounded by a threat and can't get out. You know, it's something that was used by John Carpenter for his film Assault on Precinct 13. And it's been used, and obviously it was used before that, in any number of B-real westerns. And through to films like, for example, Zulu. And those movies are really about the internal politics, the pressure, and putting the audience in the space of feeling trapped within a closed community while and being unable to escape and imprisoned by an aggressive force. The siege, obviously, in Night of the Living Dead is the thing that makes Romero so famous. He creates something new, touching on sci-fi rather than horror in terms of how the zombies are created. He never goes beyond, certainly in that first trilogy, of why they exist, apart from some kind of pseudo-scientific element about a meteorite, which they spot on television. The pseudo-scientific element pops up again and again in his work, but we'll touch on that in a bit. So you've got a film that is grounded in a reality as such, but with surrounded by of an obvious magical or mystical or horrifying or supernatural threat. And what that gives is a layer of realism. I think that modern day zombie films, if we're being honest, could probably do with a knowing threat. I mean, the Walking Dead gets criticised a lot, but for me it always felt like a Stephen King mini movie stretched out for hours and hours and hours. I know Romero was known for it, but noted for calling it a bit of a soap opera. But I can understand why. What it does is it takes some of the tropes that Romero had created in Night and Dawn and kind of rejigs it into this ongoing serial format. And that is what a soap opera is eventually, just an ongoing serial about human conflict. As a child, what really excited me, apart from the fact that I do always enjoy watching a late night horror film, was that you felt really part of it, though. You felt in those rooms. It starts quite quickly. You know, you're locked in the farmhouse from about 15 minutes in. And there are a couple of good performances, in particular Dwayne Jones, who plays Ben, is excellent in that movie. And the teenage kids feel like they're from the 1950s, as does the grouchy old man. But on the whole, the film has a certain documentary positivity, energy, kinetic energy too. Probably in reality more because they were filming very fast because they didn't have a lot of money. Now, you know, we spoke about Ed Wood, a man who had to conserve film stock. And obviously that worked against him. He had to use some shots he probably wouldn't have used given half the chance. Romero, through luck and planning, didn't have too much to worry about that. There's also some crazy stuff. They basically filmed it in order. And when the zombie smashes the car window, early doors, he covered Romero, who was holding the camera, with glass. Could have effectively smashed the camera. And Night of the Living Dead, possibly at that stage, because they wouldn't have any money to replace the camera, would no longer exist, or would not have been made in the first place, I should say. So there's an alternative universe out there, if you believe in that kind of stuff, where Night was ruined, and they only had, you know, 5 minutes worth of footage they probably would bang together for a short or whatever. I mean, Dawn of the Dead, for me, is probably the film that definitely kind of kick-started my love for horror generally in Romero. And again, the reasons for that, I think, are that you are in a space with those characters. I think the first version I saw was what is called the director's cut, but it's actually an extended cut of the film that goes into, I think it's 2 hours and 15 minutes. That additional time is not really used for anything other than being in that space with those characters. They are, the film increases the amount of time where it's breathing, and our characters are in that shopping mall space. I suppose for Romero, and the reason why Night of the Living Dead became so famous was because of its ending. In truth, it's a bleak ending, but also one that carried quite heavy political weight at the time because of Dwayne being a black man and then being shot by a posse after surviving the ill effects of the night with the ghouls trying to kill him. You know, he gets away with it. In factual fact, he does the thing that is recommended to him, he does, which is lock himself in the basement and manages to get away with killing, you know, well, yeah, I mean, get away with, you know, not being eaten, but only then to succumb to the authorities. And, you know, it is a very powerful scene, you know, at the end of basically a man saying another one for the fire. I mean, that's in 1968 when the film was released, with the civil rights movements in full swing. Its parallels must have been very obvious. Now, Romero has always said that was a happy accident. It wasn't what he'd intended. But for me, I think it's, well, A, that's fair enough. that's what he sees. But also, I think it's quite fascinating that, you know, well, first things first, any accidental reading, you know, if it doesn't matter from a critical point of view whether Romero meant it or not, that is an established reading of that police now from an arts criticism point of view. But also from a point of view that I find it fascinating. I think the thing about Romero in that film is he talks about a lot of it being by accident. I think when we go to Dawn of the Dead, none of it is. It's very deliberate. I saw a reading of it recently that compared it to saying it was influenced by Vietnam, which I found fascinating. And again, I suppose, you know, any kind of trope like that, I mean, definitely there is an element of criticism and of a consumer culture and locking yourself away from the realities of the world through bubbles, shiny things. And in the end, the real world does encroach. The barriers at the door aren't just the zombies who are enamored with the pleasant memories that they still have somewhere in the back of their minds of being on and in a shopping mall buying things they don't need, I suppose, to, you know, a more aggressive front of people who are willing to take and steal and smash with the biker gang at near the end of the film, a catalyst for our finale. Unlike Night, it has a slightly promising, hopeful ending. Although, you know, the promise of an island somewhere, maybe, perhaps, or at least reprieve from the violence, is there. And obviously, that is something that does pop up again in Day of the Dead, where Romero decides that he really should kind of give them at least the promise of an ending. It's interesting with the Dawn of the Dead remake that promise is removed. You know, the bleakness is pinpointed and highlighted at the end of that film as they chug away to hopeful safety and sanctuary, only to be hordes of running infected coming towards them while the heavy metal music plays. I think for me, Romero plays with, you know, after such a grim ending with Night, he then kind of decides that if you're going to spend a lot of time with these people, you should probably kind of at least give them the chance or the possibility of survival. So stepping away from those initial three zombie movies, I think it's interesting as well that, you know, Night of the Living Dead did not get good reviews. Hard, I know, it is to imagine. But Night did not get good reviews. It was at the time criticized for its violence in the sense that it was too much, too gory, too oppressive and violent and horrible. And Romero, who at the time had gone from a commercial background, struggled to come up with a solution. Romero does not go back to making zombie movies. I think that's the key thing we need to say. Night of the Living Dead, makes no one any money because they messed up the copyright. And B was critically kind of initially panned, certainly in the US. Its fame was only spotted, and its ability as a film, as a political text, was only really spotted in France a few years later. Romero had to scrape the money together to make his second movie in 1971. There's Always Vanilla. Now, this is coming out in a box set. In the autumn. I mean, I think it's October time from Arrow. And I'm wondering what people are going to think when they see this box set, because it is very different to what you would imagine. From my own point of view, I spent a long time and quite a lot of money trying to get a hold of various copies of the other stuff, the other Romero films. There's Always Vanilla became kind of a holy grail kind of release, really. In the end, I picked it up with a something weird video DVD from America. But the thing that's really striking about that film, and you'll be able to spot it all in glorious 2K scan from Arrow, it looks brilliant, is it's incredibly cheap and it's quite rough, and I think budgetary constraints did not help Romero make his movie. But also, it's a romantic comedy that doesn't really fit within the boundaries of being a romance as such. Romero says he's not a fan And I think that's possibly because it's quite clunky. And it's quite basic, really. It's about a guy called Chris who kind of drifts through life, returns to Pittsburgh, obviously because that's where Romero's film and stuff from, so it's by his home. And visits his old girlfriend, and basically kind of just drifts back into people's lives. And and falls for Judith, who is Barbara from Night of the Living Dead. And it's basically, you know, about somebody who feels kind of lost in the world and can't really get past from his military past. And yeah, there's a lot of like themes that aren't properly developed, and it feels well, what it is, which is a cheap, poorly thought out B movie. But look forward to that bad boy one when you pay 20 odd quid for it from Arrow. But it's interesting though. Romero, obviously, you know, there's all, from a filmmaker who has done so much and is known for so many things, his second movie is none of those things. The only thing I'd say about it is that it kind of, it much like Night, it's cut filled with a kind of a grim reality that maybe, just maybe, things aren't really going to be okay. After that, a year later, he made another film, which feels more like the kind of stuff that certainly, you know, if you were going to bill it within his oeuvre, you compare it with Martin. Mainly because it's about people who get involved in something, and there's an element of what is real and what is not. And if I say I am something, therefore am I something? Okay, so Season of the Witch is fascinating. It's early 70s in terms of suburban setting, and it's about a woman called Marion who practices witchcraft with her friends, and they dabble, basically. It's called Jack's Wife, and it was done, again, very cheaply. And then it got marketed as a softcore porn under the name Hungry Wives, and struggled under that name, mainly because it's not a porno at all. And it's certainly not, it's not that particularly exploitative. And then finally gets re-released as Season of the Witch years later. And I think that's the title it's getting released as again now. Jack's Wife, or Season of the Witch, or whatever you want to call it, if even Hungry Wives, if you want, although that was quite substantially cut down, is a rather interesting movie. It feels quite grindhousey, I think, because it's quite cheaply done. There's some nice shots in there, and it's a bit long, basically. It's a bit long. But this idea of going, you know, of somebody kind of flirting with the you know, seedy realities with fantastical supernatural elements that could or could not be true is something that he really nails down later on with Martin, one of his best films. Before that, he makes a different movie called The Crazies. I find it bizarre that someone's remade The Crazies. It was not successful when it came out. And again, it kind of found its audience on home video. Mainly, I think, much like people like myself who were like, I want all the Romero movies. I want them all. And it's so important to me. Those first two zombie movies were so important to me. I want to see everything he does, because when he does something, he does it interestingly. The Crazies, his version from 73, is quite slow. But for me, it's always reminded me of the early David Cronenberg films that he did in Canada. So, Rabid in particular. And two, you know, although there is far more interesting themes going on in Shivers and Rabid, it has the same look, the same feel, kind of a element of chaos. Romero's far more interested in the breakdown of that society, as what happens is a biological military bit of kit goes off and drives everyone completely nuts and violent. It's quite tense from that point of view, quite vicious in some of the gore, and what it does is kind of make you feel disorientated. It's a film about not liking your neighbours or feeling that your neighbours are coming to attack you. I don't think I watched The Crazies until the mid-noughties, if I was being honest. It was low down on my list of things I was interested in. In reality, I was far more interested in trying to get a hold of a copy of Season of the Witch or There's Always Vanilla, mainly because it was just, they were just so hard to get hold of. So I was like, well, I want to see those ones. I mean, what's there? What could possibly be there that makes them so difficult? The fact that they are, particularly with Season of the Witch, quite challenging movies in terms of their runtime and what they're trying to say. Hadn't occurred to me at the time. I was just really desperate to go and see them. And The Crazies felt like something I could get hold of. And indeed, you know, I think I've still got that Anchor Bay Blue knocking around, and I will be picking up the Great Arrow box set. But as a passage of films, and again, I think this is the fascinating thing, that, you know, you can lash Romero's name on that and sell them. They really just kind of nod to things he's going to do, with the exception possibly of There's Always Vanilla, which it doesn't really connect with anything. You've got The Crazies, which kind of is a dry run for some of the themes that come up in Dawn of the Dead. You've got, it's very much, I think for me, a kind of establishing film between the two. And again, it leads to a remake, which I think is strange, a 2010 remake, which is a decent enough movie. It feels a bit 70s now. I think a lot of work did, to be fair. They were very contemporary, shall we say. And then obviously, Season of the Witch, nods more prominently to Martin. Now, this, the other side of it is that it's rather cheekily, that box set kind of asserts that these are the films that Romero did between Dawn and Night. Yeah, he did, but he did another film as well. And that film is this vampire movie that doesn't necessarily have a vampire in it. Martin is quite slow, quite meditative, much like Season of the Witch from that point of view, but captures the imagination more. I suppose you could argue that these themes of not feeling part of stuff, as with Season of the Witch and also with There's Always Vanilla, of relationships that are kind of doomed to fail, definitely like in There's Always Vanilla, sit in Martin. But I think it's, and almost certainly, it had a far better marketing campaign and enough money behind it to work. Makes it a bit different, in truth. So you've got something like, you know, I mean, it was remarked as Vampire, which is a longer cut. The Italian cut's a longer cut, with some Goblin, I think, if I remember right, doing the soundtrack. But that film is, I think, kind of ties in a lot of the stuff that he was thinking about and meditating on through those three movies, but does it in a far clearer way and utilizes its gut punch, fairly unfriendly ending to really kind of shock and grab the audience. At its heart, it's about a young misunderstood boy who may or may not be suffering from either a supernatural ailment or a mental ailment. And he does some pretty awful things, some really awful things in truth, but is such a victim of his own circumstances that you kind of, if not forgive, then understand. It's kind of deeply sad, Martin. And again, because it's quite slow paced, it doesn't possibly get the reputation it deserves. But as with all Romero movies, it isn't really about the gore, although he kind of does like adding that. It's more about being with these characters for a period of time. And I think when he kind of avoids doing that, sometimes the story can kind of fall apart and you're kind of left with some dodgy dialogue. And then Dawn, which we've spoken about already briefly. Dawn had a huge impact on me when I was growing up. Bearing in mind that I would have been a teenager in the 90s. And Dawn was a 20-year-old film by that stage, probably. Maybe a little less. And in everything else in my life, I was, very much the most modern thing, the most up-to-date thing. All my music was, really, really like that out that week. And I'm assuming, but my film tastes were the opposite, I suppose. There was some stuff, like, I don't know, Trainspotting or whatever, being a teenager, that stuff kind of sticks in the mind. But with Dawn, it felt like a different world. And it made complete sense to me, and I'm not sure why. The shopping mall experience, I suppose, was still very much a 90s kind of feeling, and it was that the cultural landscape, certainly in Northern England at that point, was of these kind of encroaching big spaces. Outer towns, shopping developments started to become more of a thing. People going out to shop. The grimness of Liverpool in the 80s had kind of been stepped aside to if not a better version of Liverpool, which probably happened more about 15 years ago in truth in the early noughties, but certainly a more optimistic version of Liverpool, one that was about celebrating and partying and nightclubs and dance music. And obviously that stuff brings that commercialism, and where in the past Liverpool was very much a city of independence, independent businesses. Not completely, obviously it's ridiculous, we won't all come to the local butchers. But certainly in those villages, where I grew up was like West Derby, which is a mile, quite affluent, I suppose, middle class area. All those businesses were small businesses. I think there was a supermarket and that was about it. But even our supermarket was like a cheap budget one. There's the suggestion that somehow it was like a Waitrose or something, but it wasn't. It was, affluence is all subjective, I think, in a city like Liverpool. And, and there was all lots of local independent businesses. But then suddenly this threat of bigger consumerism came in. And obviously as a teenager growing up, watching things like Daria or whatever, and that kind of Beavis and Butthead stuff and that American culture and kids going to the mall was a thing that we'd see. And then for it to be completely skewered so viciously, so violently, took my, really, really took my breath away. And if I was being honest, because I was so obsessed with that film, when I discovered it had been cut, I needed to see the other stuff. And that kind of led on to wanting to write more about things like the Video Nasties and that kind of thing. And, I suppose if Dawn of the Dead was my adrenaline boost that got me into that kind of violent video, then, it was the reason for a lot of my writing moving forward, I suppose, because I wanted that same buzz, that same excitement, that same otherworldliness that I got from Night of the Living Dead, certainly from Dawn of the Dead, and that feeling of being with those people and these terrible things happening, and all being part of this swirling, shocking entertainment that had something to say. And so, you can, like all horror, you're an addict for your fix on, I wanted another one of those, that type of fix. Which is probably indeed also why I was running out trying to get hold of it at a point when it was hard to get hold of stuff. More Romero, bootleg videos, imports, stuff like that. Important films from America was expensive. It was really expensive at the time. Because now you don't need to worry about it. It's all on like Shudder or something, but you know, you can just buy it on iTunes. But at the time, it was hard going, man. It was really hard going. And indeed, that was something that films became a... Well, I was stockpiling all this stuff. It became really apparent to me that there were films like Knight Riders, which I really wanted to see, but was a nightmare to get hold of. In the end, I think my mate got an imported DVD. I mean, this is not that long ago, I don't know, 15 years. And we watched that, all about these joust. And it was watching it going, what is this? It makes no sense to me at all. Why are we watching this? Knight Riders was really surreal. And, you know, you got Ed Harris on a motorbike doing jousts. And then all the chivalry is like old medieval chivalry. And it was fascinating. I mean, it wasn't like the other stuff. It wasn't even like the, you know, the stuff that I knew had been, you know, slightly poorly received. It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. But again, because it creates this world that you're not part of, and you're just in that world with these characters running completely on its own rules, like a complete group of outsiders. And there's something really romantic about that, I think. And really kind of touching. And again, you know, if we're going to talk about those elements of Romero, beyond just fucking zombies or whatever, or monsters or ghouls, the elements of, you know, what makes a Romero movie, what makes it feel special. I think a lot of people in all these podcasts, no doubt you'll be hearing, will be talking about his themes on social commentary, things he becomes obsessed by. And indeed, later on, there are still things he's obsessed by that are different. And but at the same time, he's obsessed being a guy from the 60s with counterculture, outsider culture. Now that outsider culture can be trying to create a little bit of heaven in a shopping mall for a few weeks because outside is horrendous. Or it can be creating a strange kind of group of like carnival act, motorbike, jousters, creating violent, games tournaments for the unsuspecting public. I mean, that kind of world kind of sits as much in Todd Brown and Freaks, of kind of opening their gate into a community that's potentially different to the one you're from, as it is, you know, an action movie. And indeed, Knight Riders is an action movie, but at the same time, it's also a romance. There's comedy in there. It's a slice of a very different life. Again, there is a very nice arrow box with that in, with some nice liner notes, which I would recommend. And then from there, it becomes clear that Stephen King, the writer, also has a very close understanding bond with Romero. He's obviously seen Dawn and it's really affected him, and he wants to work with him. So in 82, we get Creepshow. Now, Creepshow is, again, something I think I've spoken about already. It's not that surprising when I start talking about this stuff that these films have kind of sat with me all my life. The films I've returned to time and time again. A Scream, Creepshow at a community cinema a year and a half ago. And it plays really well. It still plays really well. It's comic booky. It's funny. It's got a lot of good comments in it. Very, very enjoyable movie. And from there, Romero made his TV series, which obviously made him quite a lot of money, I'm sure, Tales from the Dark Side, which varied in quality, but does have some absolute killer episodes. And of course, it's worth bearing in mind as well, I think that story of, you know, well, what was Romero doing in the 70s between, you know, these three movies was, well, he was making stuff. He made a TV series called The Winners, which was about sport and about, you know, baseball players that went on to win some. And he did a documentary of O.J. Simpson called Juice on the Loose, which, bearing in mind what happened to O.J., is possibly not the best, the best title ever. But, yeah, and, you know, he was working. I think, and that's worth bearing in mind, because there are periods in this story when Romero appears to just stop, and he's not stopping. He's developing other stuff or working on things, and just not getting it. It's not happening. We'll talk about that when we get to the '90s. But Creepshow led to Day of the Dead, which was a movie which I think he thought he was going to get more money than he did for from producers, and when the money was pulled, what he wanted was to make the grand zombie movie, the big ultimate zombie film, like a sweeping epic. And when you read that script, which you can get online, of the Day of the Dead script, there are elements of what's in the shooting script and the reality of Day of the Dead. But its scale is big. Romero was a guy, I think, who wanted a bit more money for a bit more scale in his films. Even though, you know, I think personally he's at his best when he's smaller. Day of the Dead is when I remember it, in the '90s was the maligned zombie movie, not as good as Dawn and Night. Good, but you know, not quite there. That seems to have completely changed now. Everyone seems to be utterly convinced that Day of the Dead's a work of genius. And I think that touches on something that I think it's always fair to say with a lot of Romero's work, with the exception of Dawn, he tends to get rediscovered and reevaluated. Now, that's possibly because a lot of his satire is a little bit on the nose. So, Night of the Living Dead is basically written as, you know, far more intelligent a film than possibly even George had envisaged when he was making it. And Day doesn't have as much of that social commentary in there, except it kind of does. There's a comment about science and about army, about the, you know, tools and violence, and also about the feeling that the world of science can be frightening, violent, and unpleasant. From there, Romero does a few more films in a chunk and then a break. So we get Monkey Shines, which I haven't seen in a long time. If I was being honest, it's one of my less favoured movies from his canon. Monkey Shines is a story about a man who is ill, is a quadriplegic, disabled, I suppose I should say, and he has a trained monkey to help him. And now the concept behind all this is that, you know, like a lot of this stuff, you get a chimp, they're all right when they're little, but as they get older, they become more aggressive and more violent. And in Monkey Shines, it's basically a film about a man who is locked in with potentially violent animal. And indeed, Ella, who is the chimp, is able not just to, you know, potentially attack the quadriplegic, but also kind of do his bidding and do far more than our man possibly had intended initially. It is, I found it all a bit strange and a bit tasteless, if I was being honest. But certainly, you know, it's an unusual film and it has an interesting idea. And, I think that's reflected in the release. I think as well, you know, you look at films like Let Me Come Next. So he did his, well, it was Two Evil Eyes, which is basically half a movie, where he does yet another zombie take with, and the other half of the film is Argento doing a version of The Black Cat, which was, again, not bad. It feels direct-to-video. And then there's the slightly more higher-budget movie, The Dark Half, which was based, again, on a Stephen King book, and kind of sits, I think, in more in the pantheon of film, you know, adaptation of Stephen King's books, what I have known from the 90s, rather than anything more than that. It's it certainly doesn't have any of the magic that Creepshow has or the enthusiasm, but it's a perfectly solid, adaptable 90s horror film about that. Then there's Dead Space for years. Years and years. Romero doesn't make a movie because effectively the studios are paying for him to develop, in particular, things like Resident Evil as a film. He did a TV ad for Japanese Resident Evil 2, and it looked good. It felt good. And that was part of Capcom spending a lot of money to get people to purchase that game for PlayStation. And that led to him being in the dev deal for Resident Evil for a long time. And he would probably know that handsomely paid for his time to do that. When he returned, we got Bruiser, which again is a film that I ended up having to go out and find. I don't think it's available in the UK still. Bruiser is a story about a man who feels his identity is robbed from him and reacts to that by being given more freedom. It's an interesting concept. And again, what it does is put you next to a character for an extended period of time. It's far more a character piece than it is a horror piece as such, or a, you know, an action movie, which is probably where it would more likely be. The film was created and distributed in various different places. Didn't particularly get picked up. I ended up having to get a Norwegian DVD import, I think it was, of it to watch it. And I found it fun, a little strange. I think Romero was really keen on this idea that this white mask would, you know, if you take away somebody's own visage, you know, what do they become? Are they more base in their instincts? Are they more violent? Are they more willing to attack? And what does that really mean? Is that not just a mindset? You know, who is running who? Is the mask running the man? Or is the man just doing it anyway? And it's something he plays about with through the runtime of the movie. I think what a lot of people saw in that film that was a film about a revenge movie with a strange kind of mask gimmick, which probably looked good on the front of the VHS case or the DVD case, depending on when you picked it up. But I think that's probably a little harsh for Bruiser. Again, I'm not saying that this is a lost classic from him. I don't think it is. But it's definitely, there's definitely more to it than people give it credit for. But while he, you know, that film is busy struggling elsewhere, suddenly the zombie renaissance happens, and Romero is now the godfather of zombie movies, and suddenly this all feels very different, and we get three films from him over a period of 4 years. His last three movies between 2005 and 2009, although I think Survival actually got released in 2010. Land of the Dead was Romero's moment to make his big zombie film. And it was his mainstream film, basically, more so even than Creepshow or Monkey Shines or The Dark Half, all of which, you know, The Dark Half is an MGM horror movie. It's a proper film. You know, it's designed to be maybe, set, you know, do all right on the box office and really make its money on the rental market. But nonetheless, was a big release. Land of the Dead was a big release. That is very much, this is George A. Romero returning to the zombie movie. K- kind of ignoring the fact that, you know, he'd already made a zombie film and two evil eyes. But that again, and Creepshow as well, has its zombie elements. But at the time, Land of the Dead did not get the greatest reception in the world. But I think people have kind of been a little bit warmer to it now. I think the reason why the warmer to Land is, it feels very much like it's Romero's post 9/11 film. It's a very much us and them kind of movie. A movie about the barricades being even higher. And I think for the first time in its creation of one of his zombie movies, Romero is insinuating that maybe you're not the people in the mall. Maybe you're the people outside struggling to get in, or at best, the people who sit in poverty, you know, safe from the threat, but in danger of pretty much anything else, you know, the downtrodden, while at the top of the penthouse, the money flies around and people do what they want. Certainly, when you look at Empire of the Dead, his comic book series, that's something that continues as a theme that's in his head. But Diary of the Dead and Survival of the Dead, which kind of sit outside of the other zombie movies he's made, and I'll group them together, mainly because I really like Diary of the Dead. I've only watched Survival once. I'm still not really getting around to watching it again, although I will do it at some point. Diary of the Dead was originally designed to be screened online. He made a film. His idea was that there'd be a pay gate, you know, go to diaryofthedead.com and watch the streaming movie, you know, pay $1, $2 and watch the streaming movie, which at the time was quite ahead of its time, you know, bearing in mind 2007. And, you know, I think broadband was about 2 gig, you know, two mega second if you were paying the big bucks at that stage, maybe 8 meg if you're really, really splashing out, you know. We ain't saying it this, what do we got now? I've got 50 meg and that's like the cheapest I can get. And, you know, and the film reflected that environment that it was designed to be watched in. And the criticisms of the film, and I think I might have touched on this, I've certainly touched on it on other people's podcasts, the criticisms of Land of the Dead, I mean, sorry, Diary of the Dead, are always that he doesn't understand how people act. So he doesn't understand how kids are not going to be putting music over the top of the scares, which we all know they fucking would do now, because they do it on YouTube. And also, you know, who's editing this? This is a zombie apocalypse. Why would people upload this stuff to the internet? Of course they're going to do that. Of course they are. Because what Romero understood was that people are, and young people and people generally are, nefariously living through their lives, through the digital media that they have created. So they, you know, a life is told through an iPhone and Insta and iTunes and Clips and WhatsApp groups and all that shit. It isn't lived necessarily as much as Romero saw it in these groups of people, whether they feel like outsiders, like in Knight Riders, or are trying to escape the world through consumerism in Dawn of the Dead, or indeed just people who just fucking don't get on with each other, who have to coexist in day. Romero's reflection of the modern world sits in Diary of the Dead as a frustration. A frustration that we're now filming stuff through cameras. Now, this was effectively a found footage movie before found footage really took off again. You know, Paranormal Activity was made in 2007, the same year that Diary of the Dead was released, but actually was released in 2009 and kind of led to this ongoing thing where we've got way too many. And that's entirely, again, because of the way we live our lives now and through this kind of technology, this mobile, internet-enabled technology that's with us, that we can film on. Now, that is not to say that Diary of the Dead is some kind of trailblazer in the world of horror. It isn't. I don't think it's been particularly influential, if I'm being honest. Certainly not in the same way Paranormal Activity was influential. Or, you know, going back to that found footage thing, Cannibal Holocaust was. But that is not to say that its themes and its ideas aren't good, because they are. And I understand a lot about Day of the Dead. And I know what it does do is kind of really ramp up the fact that Romero says, let's do this in post. Let's use CGI for this. And he used it a lot in Land of the Dead, but he can get away with it because he's got a fucking massive universal budget behind him keeping that ship afloat. With Diary and with Survival, he's reliant on goodwill and kids with computers, and that's what impacts on the quality of that CGI. So you get some great kills, like exploding eyeballs and all this kind of stuff, and people getting ripped in half, but it's all done on a computer, and it doesn't connect with the audience in the same way. Survival, and again, I am remembering this, is about a family feud. And it's about a locked off area, and if I was being honest, it probably has more in its DNA with Walking Dead, because it's about people in a place arguing. Which, in fairness to Romero, is an ongoing theme. And also it has some increasingly silly moments on. Now, silly mainly because Romero wrote the rules on zombies. So his world, is his. But whenever he kind of strays into doing stuff about zombies that are more intelligent, and that starts with Bub in Day of the Dead, which I think, again, is now kind of being forgiven, but at that time it was not. It was like, that's a bit weird. And then it's kind of increased and increased and increased through more intelligent zombies. Survival has those kind of elements in it throughout, I think, and people are a bit weird about it. But Land is very much, it's almost like a working class uprising as a metaphor, certainly. And again, mainly because of this us and them variations. And it's something he then goes back to one last time with Empire of the Dead. Now, Empire of the Dead, it was a Marvel comic book run. Did 15 issues. Apparently AMC took a look to pick it up at one point. I think mainly because they wanted George Romero's Empire of the Dead. I'm pretty sure that the development of that story would have been very different to the comics. Why? Because it's got intelligent zombies in there again. Zombies that talk and can communicate. And it's got vampires in it. And that actually sits within the world of the original Dead trilogy. It's it's around about the same time as Land of the Dead in terms of its time etymology, maybe a little bit later. But these are enclave cities using Romanism almost to control the masses. And I think in the UK we always kind of say, well, the Tories are lizards. I know, certainly around these parts, like they kind of, that there is a an exception that maybe they're otherworldly, and the people in power are like doing this because they're not like us. And that is very true in Empire of the Dead, and indeed they are not like us. If you've not read them, but you're a Romero fan, I think you will spot some of the things that people, you will always kind of think about Romero. Most notably the fact that the dialogue could have done with another go at. You could have done with a re-edit, but no one's obviously took him to one side and said you should really have another go at that, George. And then that's a problem that he's had through Night of the Living Dead right the way for his career, that the scripts that he writes have great themes, great ideas, but sometimes the execution of the interaction between the characters can be a little bit off. And that isn't with Empire. And also, he struggles sometimes to end his stories. He creates this amazing world, and it is a good world in Empire. Really fascinating, but then kind of struggles to understand, well, where does this go? That's not that surprising. Your starting point is the decay of all civilization into a dystopian vision of the future. It's always difficult to kind of, you either go uplifting, like in a Mad Max kind of way, and then leave, or you make it completely disintegrate. And because it's a zombie movie, you're kind of there for the disintegration. So I think, particularly with Empire, he struggled with that. So I think what I've just done there is say, what I'm not going to do is kind of go through all his films and talk about them and blah, blah, blah. And I think that's exactly what I have done. But the thing about George Romero for me is he got into films because he watched Tales of Hoffman when he was young. And he wanted to make them not because Tales of Hoffman was so beautiful or so such a great musical opera. He wanted to get into it because he could see how it was done on the screen. The technicality, the theatricality of that film was on the screen. And he saw that and went, I want to do that. I understand this language of cinema. And everything he did from there, even when he flirted with, you know, when he was getting paid to not make Resident Evil effectively, or when he was getting paid, you know, F all really to make one last zombie movie, which is Survival of the Dead, which in fairness, probably to George, he didn't really need to make. He didn't certainly didn't have an idea in the same way he did with his other films from that curve of cinema. So instead what we get is something a bit different. But at the same time, he does it on his own terms. And all of his work, in the same way that Night of the Living Dead is the same as Tales of Hoffman. You can see it. It's all there. You know how that film was made. It feels very real and very organic and very truthful to the situation. Well, as truthful as it can be with hordes coming at the doors. And Dawn's the same, with the exception of some of the more interesting special effects shots which were provided by Savini. Sorry. He was able to create a world that you felt part of. You were part of that world. And it's a you know, I think we live in a world where the zombie apocalypse is almost fetishized. Like, well, I'll be the one who survives. So there'll be 400,000 fucking zombies in Liverpool, but I'll be the one who gets away. And that's because of how George placed you as a person within that world, and he made characters that you empathized with, you wanted to be with. And God, Jesus, if only more horror films spent the time like that, making you understand the people you're with, rather than, you know, Hostel, where you spend 45 minutes with people being dickheads, and God fucking bring on the torture chamber, or Saw, where they're reduced a lot of the times to one character flaw. This is this person. She has taken drugs. This is this person. He is fat. Now watch them getting carved up. And that's, you know, the slasher films of the 80s. You know, kids basically getting cut up for some kind of misdemeanor, which is a useless moralistic ideal. You know, Romero, for all his faults as a writer with dialogue, was able to create people that you could get behind. When that car explodes because they absolutely balls up their plan and Night of the Living Dead, that's a gut punch. Those kids didn't deserve to die. Not like that. But you just kind of accept it. You have to. And it's that horrific moment is when the disintegration really starts to take hold on the environment. So yeah, George Romero, almost certainly and most definitely the reason why I'm sitting here talking to you today. Not just because of the topic of the podcast, but the topic of, I don't even know anymore, 200 podcasts. So cheers, George. I'll raise a glass to you tonight.
In 1968, George Romero brought us Night of the Living Dead. It became the classic horror film of its time. Now, George Romero brings us the most intensely shocking motion picture experience for all times.
It gets up and kills. The people it kills get up and kill. This situation must be controlled before it's too late. They are multiplying too rapidly.
Dawn of the Dead.
Meet me on the roof at 9 o'clock. Get out.
I don't believe
it.
We're
going to get out in the chopper. We've got to survive. Somebody's got to survive.
They kill for one reason. They kill for food.
They eat their victims.
Imagine, if you will, that something has gone terribly wrong.
Shoot it, man.
Now, accept the fact that there's no escaping the horrible consequences. George Romero brings back the dead. Night of the Living Dead has ended. Dawn of the Dead is here.
We must not be lulled by the concept that these are our family members or our friends. They are not. They will not respond to such emotions.
Operated dead. Post abandoned. We may never get out of the room.
It's everywhere.
What the hell is it?
Looks like a shopping center, one of those big indoor malls.
What are they doing? Why do they come here?
Some kind of instinct, memory, what they used to do. This was an important place in their lives.
What is it?
We've got a war.
We have spawned our own savagery. Soon, it will consume us all. It is a horrible, hauntingly accurate vision of the mindless excesses of a society gone mad.
They must be destroyed on sight!
When there is no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth.
We are down to the line, folks. We are down to the line.
Dawn of the Dead.
Okay, thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that. You want to get hold of me, please do. My email address is christopher@thelasthorrorpodcast.com, or go to the website, thelasthorrorpodcast.com, where there is loads of things. You get me on Twitter @Andre_monkey, and I will endeavour to reply to you. I'm not the best at it all the time, but I will definitely contact you. Until next time, take care, and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.